Good morning. I'm going to call the April 6, 2022 Board of Directors meeting of the Eastern Municipal Water District to order. If we could all stand, I'm going to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance this morning. I'll stand and face the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I ask the board secretary if she would call the roll and discuss how people can participate in the meeting through our webcast. And I will also acknowledge before you do that I believe Director Record is going to be absent today, correct?
That's correct. Director Corona?
Here.
Director Slauson?
Here.
Director Armstrong?
Here.
And our legal counsel is here as well as President Pauly. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go over the guidelines for virtual participation in EMWD board meetings. To avoid creating acoustic feedback, please mute all your devices during the meeting unless you are speaking. Before speaking, please unmute your device and turn down the volume of any other devices that are near you and tuned into the meeting. If you have joined by phone and would like to comment on an item, please press star 9 to let our staff know and wait to be notified. When it is your turn to speak, you will hear a notification asking you to unmute your phone by pressing star 6. If you have joined by computer, you may use the chat feature in Zoom to indicate your desire to speak. When done speaking, please mute your device again. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are speaking.
Thank you so much. April, do we have anybody wishing to do public comment this morning at our board meeting?
Not that I'm aware of.
Very good. That will take us to our executive reports. Mr. Mawad, good morning, sir.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. My report is included in your packet. Under new and ongoing items, I'm pleased to share with you that on March 21st, we were notified by the State Department of Water Resources that we have been awarded $2.5 million for the Well 37 project. This funding comes from the 2021 Urban and Multi-Benefit Drought Relief Program. As you're aware, Well 37 is part of our integrated recharge and recovery program. It's going to allow us to extract imported water from the State Water Project that will be subsequently recharged into the San Jacinto Basin and allow us to use that water during drought and dry years. So it's a very significant grant award, and I'm very pleased with the results. It's going to cover about 60% of the overall project cost, and the project is scheduled to commence construction in October of this year. I wanted to thank the entire EMWD team that assisted in the pursuit of this grant and really congratulate them on this achievement. Also, on March 24th, we hosted Mr. Gary Gold, who was appointed by President Biden as the Assistant Deputy Secretary for Water and Science with the Department of Interior, as well as Ms. Stacy Wade, who serves as the Lower Colorado Basin Deputy Regional Director with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. It was a great opportunity to get to know them, to brief them on our long-standing partnership between EMWD and the Bureau of Reclamation. We also had a chance to provide them a tour of our facilities, including our recycled water system, as well as our Mountain Avenue West replenishment basin. At that location, four members of the Saboba Tribal Council were able to join us for that part of the event, and we appreciated their participation to underscore the longstanding partnership we've had with the Saboba tribe. The timing of this visit was well orchestrated, if you will, because prior week we had submitted an application to the Bureau of Reclamation for $27.5 million to Title 16 in support of our Purified Water Replenishment Program, so it worked out well. I also want to mention that the day prior, on March 23rd, Rancho had scheduled an event with the dignitaries from the Bureau of Interior and the Bureau of Reclamation, and Dr. Armstrong and myself were able to attend that event. It was also extended to Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District as well as Western, so all four agencies attended that event. It was, again, a wonderful opportunity to highlight the regional collaboration to the Department of Interior and Bureau of Reclamation. As you may be aware, on April 12th, in light of the bleak water supply conditions, Governor Newsom issued an executive order with the goal of increasing conservation. The governor is asking Californians to limit summertime water use and to use water more efficiently, both indoors and outdoors. In addition, by May 25th of this year, the State Water Resource Control Board must adopt emergency regulations defining non-functional turf and develop a framework to ban irrigation of non-functional turf for commercial, institutional, and industrial sectors. Based on the governor's executive order, we responded with a letter to the Department of Resources Director Carla Nemeth and the State Board Chair Joaquin Esquivel, acknowledging and supporting the use of existing local planning tools such as the Water Supply Contingency Plan. The letter also offers EMWD as a resource to the state as they embark on developing the framework to ban irrigation on non-functional turf and to define non-functional turf. In addition to submitting the letter, we provided public comments during yesterday's state board meeting during the drought update. Under items of interest to the board, I wanted to share with you that last week, EMWD cast this ballot for the special district member representative on the Riverside LAFCO. The term for this seat is from May 6, 2022 through May 6, 2026. According to LAFCO rules, which stipulate that an agency's presiding officer shall cast the ballot, President Pauly had a conflict in that his wife had a recent business transaction, was one of the candidates. Thus, his recusal on this vote constituted an absence for the purposes of this action. Thus, according to our admin code, Vice President Record is a presiding officer, and thus Vice President Record cast the ballot on behalf of EMWD. And finally, I wanted to share with you that several of the staff members, including myself, Linnea, Nick, we participated with the Inland Empire Utilities Agency at a workshop that they held last week to discuss how we can potentially learn from each other in terms of managing groundwater resources. And it was a great opportunity to learn on their initiatives with the Chino Basin, groundwater basin, and obviously we shared our experience with our San Jacinto Basin. We also discussed opportunities to potentially work together on future groundwater banking initiatives. It was a great opportunity to collaborate with IUA, and we also had a tour of their $300 million construction project expanding their reclamation plant at RP5. And we look forward to future collaboration with IUA. With that, that concludes my report. I'd be happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Any questions for the general manager? All right. Thank you so much. We will go. I noticed Nick is not in attendance today. Laura, do you have anything for us?
Yes, President Pauly. I have a brief update on our resumption of delinquency procedures. So as the board is aware, the governor lifted the shutoff prohibition in December. And complying with SB 998 rules, we began our process of delinquency on March 14th. We resumed it. Through the last week, the Meter Services Department has delivered 2,157 door hangers to delinquent properties and performed 388 shutoffs due to nonpayment. Of those, 305, or 78%, have been restored to service following the customer making a payment or scheduling payment arrangements. So as you can be aware that our customer service calls have increased significantly since we started the shutoff process. They're calling in for assistance for payment arrangements, balance inquiries, and general billing questions. It's interesting to note that our increase in payment arrangements has increased twofold in the past 4 months with customers wanting to take care of their balances. So it's good news. I mean, starting the process again has been great for the district. We are continuing to educate our customers on our self-service app. It does allow for making payments and also making payment arrangements. So our customer service reps are available for that assistance. Dan and Charles are here if the board has any other questions, but I think business as usual, and it's working out well.
I think Director Slauson.
Do you have a breakdown of the percentage that actually paid it off entirely?
Charles?
Right. I mean, 10%, 20% paid off.
I don't have it right in front of me, but yeah, we can definitely get that for you.
I would just be curious because it would give an indication they could have paid all along.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so they're just sitting on that. Yeah, so we can definitely look at that and get that back to you.
All right. The 350 number is really pretty low considering the number of accounts we have.
Yeah, but anecdotally, I'd say most are making a smaller payment, and then the rest are going to be payment arrangements. Yeah.
Okay.
Director Armstrong, do you have a question?
No, I just wanted to make a comment. I think it's when you come out of something like this and you have these larger number of delinquencies than you might normally have, and I just think it's great that we have this payment arrangement policy and that we can help accommodate to get people back and have time to get back on their, back on track with things, because it is kind of hard to just make that one-time payment on some of them, I would imagine.
It is, and some of the balances are fairly large, as you would imagine.
Yeah.
So, yeah, payment arrangement is definitely the route to go. And ultimately, we don't want to turn people off. We want them to stay with water and continue to make payments. So that's the goal.
And from the pandemic, we've extended the time frame, correct?
We have. So the time frame for payment arrangements, we have extended it in some cases, up to 18 to 24 months. So some of those balances are fairly large. So we have extended that time. And again, the goal is to ensure that they stay with water and they continue to make payments.
That's great. Yep.
Charles, while you're there, is our program with United Way still in place to help those that literally are having some financial issues as we start catching people up?
Yes, sir. So the program you're referencing is the Help to Others program. And yes, that program is still in place. It offers a one-time bill credit of up to $200.
I think, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and that's still being funded by us?
Yeah, the funds that were approved by the board are still available, so we haven't run out of those funds. And we are mentioning that in addition to all the other assistance programs, such as LIHWAP and LIHEAP, United Lift. All those programs are available to us to assist our customers.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, this is really good news as far as I'm concerned, that we're starting to get people back in the habit of making a water bill payment, which – I've always said puts value on water, which is my biggest concern.
I agree, President Paul. It's an important transition that we're going through. The initial response has been very positive. We will continue to collect data, and we will come back with more information once we've had full rollout, if you will, and response. I know Charles and others are very much monitoring this process. But I did want to clarify one thing, President Paul. With the Help to Others, we were successful in securing some state reimbursement from their funding to replenish the water Help to Others that we expended.
That
was a good turn of events in that the state did provide us some reimbursement on that front.
Perfect. Thank you, Charles. Appreciate that update. That is good news. Linnea, good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. Last week, we held a quarterly coordination meeting with staff from Metropolitan in which we discussed a variety of projects of mutual interest, including the EM11 and associated San Diego's Pipelines 1 and 2, the DVL Marina Infrastructure, as well as the Paris Dam Seepage and Recovery Project. Metropolitan also reported that they are currently evaluating potential regional benefits of the Doheny Ocean Desalination Project and how their policies and or potential involvement in that project could influence regional partnerships or opportunities for agencies like EMWD. So we will be continuing to follow up with Metropolitan on their findings and, again, how it might influence our decisions to participate.
Very good. Any questions? Mr. Melendez.
Good morning. It's my pleasure today to introduce you all to Mr. Ken Tagney. He's our new Director of Water Reclamation. He officially started this week. Ken has a bachelor's degree in business administration. He has a grade 5 wastewater operator's certificate. And over about the last 10 years, Ken has had a number of roles here at the district in operations and maintenance, starting out as an operator. He held a position we had called Treatment Process Control Specialist, where he helped all the different plants with technical process issues. He's been a supervisor, and most recently, he was the plant manager of the Moreno Valley plant. So Ken has done a great job over the years, really stepping up, taking on additional responsibilities. He's very familiar with all of our wastewater plants and facilities. And most recently, he's been a key person and a great leader in our department in helping me get some of our important initiatives and goals achieved. So we're very excited to add Ken to the team and just wanted to tell him welcome.
All right. Welcome.
Have anything you want to add? Or
just say I'm honored and excited for the opportunity to be the director of the Water Reclamation Department. We have a great team. We have great leadership and a great agency.
Great. I'd like to note, too, that we really try to do a policy here of having people move up the ladder at Eastern. So, again, this is a great example of it. And appreciate all you've done for the agency and look forward to being in charge of all this. So, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll bring us to our consent calendar. Do I have anybody that wants to pull an item for further discussion or conflict on any of the consent items? Seeing none, I'll look for a motion and a second.
Second.
Motion by Director Corona, second by Director Armstrong. Could you make a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent for the day. We will now move on to our action calendar, which is item A, to approve and authorize an agreement with Kleinfelder for $752,000, final design of the Getz Water Storage Tank Project, and adopt a proposed resolution certifying the environmental impact report and appropriation of the amount of $1,608,000. Mr. Kowalski, good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. President, fellow members of the board. Before I get started with the presentation, I'd like to do a quick introduction of our guests from Kleinfelder today, our tank experts. We have Danny Hanna in the back here, Brian Tran, and Simon Wong.
Much, much appreciated that you came to our board meeting, so good morning.
So with that, I'll get started with the Getz Road tank project. By way of agenda, I'll walk through the location. I'll give some background. I'll walk through the program, which are the tank itself and the offsite pipelines that we're looking to advance in phases. Also give a little bit of background about the environmental process and how we're looking to advance the final design, and then provide a recommendation to advance final design as well as certify our environmental impact report. By way of location, we're located just a couple miles away southeast of here, located on the corner of Sotelo Road and Getz Road. This particular tank is approximately 8 million gallons, which will significantly reduce our deficiencies in our baseline pressure zone, which are approximately 12 million gallons. So 8 million gallons will take us to 4 million gallons going forward. By way of background on the project, we acquired property on Sotelo Road back in 2012, and soon after we advanced preliminary design. And in 2015, we initiated the first environmental document. It was an MND. And we received various public comments as well as comments from agencies. And at that time, we decided to go back to advance an environmental impact report. It was needed due to the nature of some of the impacts. With that, we advanced that process and completed the preliminary design as well as completed an environmental impact report. And since, we've now split the program into two headings to advance the project in an expedited manner. And as I said, we advanced the project now into two headings, the phasing being the transmission pipeline is moving concurrent with the tank. We look to advance the transmission pipeline to attach the tank to the local transmission system in Marietta Road. Today, we're looking to advance design for the phase two effort, which involves design of that 8 million gallon tank, as well as a related disinfection facility and site improvements. By way of environmental background, we advanced a 45-day public review for our new document that was sent out to agencies as well as the adjacent landowners through our normal process. We did receive one comment, but there were no need to update our document. We did, however, incorporate the comment and response in that document. Further, we did conduct an AB 52 tribal consultation to the local tribes. As far as environmental impact, there's various environmental impacts on the project that are typical. And in order to ensure noise and vibration are advanced during construction and managed, we have a robust monitoring and reporting program. But otherwise, the impacts are less than significant. As far as the scope of work for the final design, it's typical for a design like this, but we're going to start with preliminary design refinement and then advance to final design to prepare final contract documents, and then continue the final design process through the bidding process. By way of consultant selection, we advertised an RFP in December of last year, and in January we received 5 of 6 proposals. We put together a cross-functional selection panel consisting of engineering, field engineering, and operations and maintenance staff to review these proposals with our typical evaluation criteria. After review of those proposals, it was determined that Kleinfelder was the top-ranked firm to advance the design with a final negotiated fee of approximately $752,000. Relative to others, they provided the best value to the district moving forward. Kleinfelder has also identified various local key subconsultants to complete the work. By way of schedule, if approved today, we look to advance the project as soon as possible and complete bid documents in mid-2023, and then soon after continue right into construction to complete the project in late 24 or early 25. With that, my recommendation today is to, one, advance a contract with Kleinfelder for the final design of the project, the amount of approximately $750,000. Two, advance administrative award of other ancillary contracts to complete this work. And then three, adopt a proposed resolution certifying the environmental impact report, adopt the mitigation monitoring reporting program, adopt the findings of fact, and the statement of overriding considerations for the project. And then last but not least, our recommendation today is to add additional appropriation of just over $1 million, taking the total project to just under $3 million. So with that, that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Any questions on this item?
See none. Appreciate the presentation. I'll look for a motion in a second. Motion by Director Armstrong. Second by Director Slauson. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. We'll move on to item B, which is to approve and authorize a award of contract to Ferris Construction Company for $1.5 million. Under specification 1445S for the Temecula Plant Multipurpose Building Rehabilitation and Retrofit. Mr. Cerna, good morning.
Good morning. So again, my name is Ed Cerna. I am a principal civil engineer in the engineering department, and again, we'll be recommending an award of construction contract to Ferris Construction. So this project will take place within the Temecula Treatment Plant located in Temecula at the southern end of the district service area. The maintenance shop building was constructed in 1972. The building was originally the plant's blower building, but has been repurposed several times since then. As you can see in the picture, the building is currently used as storage. You can also see that the overall space, the building's finishes, ceiling tiles, and swamp coolers are deteriorated and require replacing. So this proposed project will rehab the building and create a multi-purpose room where plant staff can have their breaks, conduct meetings, and hold training events. In order to accomplish this, staff contracted with Gillis Panepachin Architects to design the new multi-purpose building. The rehab and retrofit work includes replacement of the entire roof system, refinishing the walls and flooring, new casework and sinks, as well as adding network capability for monitors and computers. When construction is complete, it will essentially be a new building without the major costs of foundation and walls. In February of this year, EMWD advertised a project to general contractors. Only two bidders attended the mandatory pre-bid walkthrough. On March 10, the district received one bid. As shown in the summary of bid, Ferris Construction Company submitted a bid of approximately $1.5 million. The engineer's estimate for the project was just under that at $1.4 million. If this recommendation is approved, the contractor will begin in May and complete the project no later than July 2023. So GPA is the architect of record for the project. To provide continuing engineering support during construction, GPA submitted a proposal for approximately $57,000. Their scope includes reviewing submittals, responding to RFIs, and change order support. So our recommendation today is execution of a construction contract with Ferris Construction for the Temecula Treatment Plant Multipurpose Building Rehab and Retrofit Project for approximately $1.5 million, execution of a contract with GPA for engineering services during construction for approximately $57,000, administrative award of other necessary contracts to complete the project, and additional appropriation of approximately $2.1 million, which brings a total estimated total project cost to approximately $2.3 million. And with that, I can take any questions.
Any questions on this item?
No questions.
I just had one. So Ferris Construction, have we had the opportunity to do business with them before here at Eastern?
No, I spoke with Bruce before this meeting, and we have not. Typically, we advertise projects to Class A contractors, but because of the nature of the work, we opened it up to Class A and Class B. And so... you know, they had an opportunity to bid, but, you know, bottom line.
I understand. I just, and I think I mentioned this before, and I'm going to really, going forward, if we're going to award, if this board is where things actually are awarded, if anything over $1 million and we've never done business with you, I'd like to at least have some people come to the board meeting, introduce themselves, they can call in. I just think that, to me, to earn my vote going forward, that's going to be a hard policy with me. Is I want to at least have the opportunity to see who we're doing business with going forward.
We'll absolutely do that, President Pauly, on a going forward
basis. I just
basis.
Had the example here. We had the previous item.
Absolutely.
I had three people here. I don't need that, but someone new to us, when we're doing $1 million worth of business, I just say that's common business courtesy. So
we will make sure that that's a policy on a going forward basis. I do want to add to Ed's presentation that we did check references for Ferris and make sure that they did successful work for other public agencies. So we will always do that. That's just standard practice whenever we're bringing on a new construction contractor. But absolutely, we hear you loud and clear. So we will make certain on a going forward basis that there's a contractor, construction contractor that we haven't done work with. We'll definitely ask him to have representatives.
I just consider that common business courtesy. I know when we do business with folks, that's how we conduct ourselves. So. And obviously my last comment is after looking at those pictures, this is needed. That did not look like a place I'd want to hang out. So with that, anyone want to make a motion?
I'll make the motion.
Make a motion by Director Corona, second by Director Armstrong. I saw, could I get a roll call vote?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Move on to item C, which is to approve and authorize award a contract to CDM Smith Incorporated for $296,000 for the Temecula Valley Regional Water Reclamation Facility Plant 1 Airline Replacement Project. Mr. Stone.
Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board. Before I get launched, we actually have a guest here for this item, too.
Oh.
Judy Nashimoto is in the back.
Thank you for coming.
They've done plenty of work for us in the past. However, it has been some time since they visited us, given the last couple of years, so we thought it would be appropriate to bring them in. With that, I'm going to launch. Again, this is a recommendation for award of preliminary and final design for a repair project at Temecula Valley related to the Plant 1 Air. As indicated, the project is located at the Temecula Regional Water Reclamation Facility in the south portion of the district. Background, operations notified us in December of last year that they had observed air leaking from the underground piping outside of the Plant 1 and Plant 2 blower building. They could hear air running through the ground, and actually during those rain events in December, you could see bubbles coming up through the soil. To present kind of a visual, if you remember back when we were all younger and at the beach, the sand crab bubbles from the waves. We apparently have a version of sand crabs outside the building right now. The leakage appears.
Being an engineer, I'm going to take it that's not a good thing.
No. Interestingly, this is not uncommon for air piping because the blowers run, the air heats up, and it creates moisture. So corrosion within the air piping system is a very common occurrence. So they tend to wear out a little bit more frequently than some of our other facilities. And so in order to, the project will actually be bringing this piping above grade so that we're able to monitor it better and conduct repairs in an easier manner as necessary. And so the leakage is actually coming from a portion of the pipeline that we can't isolate without shutting down a third of the capacity at the wastewater plant. So we're going to have to do some extensive work to bypass and keep air moving. Here's a photo of the air system, the aeration basins that you see in the center with the blue lines. That air piping was moved and replaced during the rehabilitation of that basin. The other piping shown is a variety of above grade and below grade. We have replaced portions of the piping within Temecula before other portions that had failed. Those were brought above grade. This is really kind of that next step to complete that work. We went out for proposals in January. We solicited those from three different consultants. All three submitted proposals. CDM was the most qualified, best value based on the selection team. And as noted, the fee is commensurate with the work that's needed. The scope includes preliminary and final design, some construction sequencing and phasing recommendations. And this goes to what I had just mentioned about not being able to truly shut down that section of pipeline so that we can keep the plant operating. Bid documents, bid services, and some construction estimating and scheduling. The schedule, should the board say yes today, will begin immediately. The final design looking to be completed in May of 2023. The construction advertisement, construction completion are listed as to be determined because those will be finally negotiated with the operations staff to best align with plant operation and other maintenance activities. This brings us to our recommendation. Our recommendation is award of a contract for preliminary and final design to CDM Smith in the amount of approximately $300,000. Administrative award of other ancillary contracts necessary to complete the design work, and finally, an appropriation of $430,000 to take us to bidding services. And that brings me to the end of the presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions the board might have.
Any questions?
Yeah, I have a question. So this is this line, is it a compressed air line?
It's low pressure, but yes. So it's not in the classic sense where we're actually using compressors like you would use to fill your tires. These are large blowers, high horsepower, several hundred horsepower that provide large volumes of air, but it is relatively low pressure.
And it's not hot air?
It heats up and draws more. It becomes humid air because of the machinery that it has to pass through. So okay. It's not hot in the sense that it's going to burn you, but it's like imagine on a very humid day, we're creating that environment within the pipeline.
Yeah, Director Corona, it's about 12 PSI on the high end, and the discharge temperature from those blowers can be up to something like 140 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's fairly warm.
Okay, so we don't have any water removal system, like a compressor. If I had a compressor, you're going to have a water removal thing in there. So or does the water get created when it goes underground and cools and then?
Yeah, so in the underground situation, the water traps are actually very difficult to install because of the depth of the piping. As we bring them above grade, we do install drains so that we can, prolong the life and keep the maintenance up.
Well, I think it's probably a good idea. If you're going to have steel pipe, to get it above ground in that area of that plant, because all that ground in the industrial area is all pretty hot. It's all pretty salty, and, it corrodes quickly, so I think that would be a good idea.
Yes, sir. So
that's all I have.
Any other questions?
Well, we had this presentation at Ops and Engineering, and I'm fully in support. But I would say that the consultant this year, CDM Smith, is obviously qualified. If she was wondering whether it was important to come, and she showed up, now she knows it's important. Yeah, we appreciate it.
We've done a lot of business with them, and I expect people who we've done a good relationship with to be here all the time. Point was with new people, I thought would be a nice person. I do really appreciate you coming. it shows the dedication of your firm, and we have a great relationship with you at this district. So with that, is there a motion? Director Slauson, would you like to make the motion?
I made that motion.
I'll second.
Second by Director Corona. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Item D is to ratify and approve a contract with 87 Contracting and Engineering Incorporated for emergency repairs to the Murrieta Town Center, not to exceed $406,000. Mr. Melendez.
Good morning. So, this item is related to the mainline leak that we had at Murrieta Town Center that we discussed in closed session a couple weeks ago. Today's meeting in closed session, we're going to have a more detailed and thorough update for you and be able to answer questions. However, we do need to bring this item to you to ratify the expenses that we've incurred so far on the repairs. And so costs to date are about $116,000 to do the excavations and repair the two joints. We have issued a PO for them to backfill and do some site restoration. So the total amount that we're asking today for ratification is about $324,000. And then there's a recommendation to approve and authorize potential future work to make one additional joint repair if it becomes necessary. And the dollar amount for that is $81,000, $81,500. And so the total not to exceed amount for H7 that we're asking for at this time is $406,000. So that is the amount we're asking to cover things. We don't expect to spend the whole amount, but that's the recommendation for this morning.
Any questions? I'll make the motion on this one. Do I have a second?
I'll second it.
Director Slauson, could you call the roll, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Item E is to ratify and approve the Temecula Valley Regional Water Reclamation Facility Primary Influent Pipeline Emergency Repairs, not to exceed $340,000.
Okay, so you might recall I gave an update right at the new year that on Christmas Eve we had an emergency at the Temecula plant. The influent pipeline that takes water from Headworks to Plant 1 had a failure, and we had wastewater coming out of the ground. So the staff did a great job of responding to that and stopping the spill. And we've been working diligently since then to come up with a good method to repair this line. The star is where the leak occurred, and that pipeline conveys water to the west. You can see the original Plant 1 in the yellow square there. These are some photos on the day of the incident. It was raining off and on, but here's the flow of wastewater. On the right, you can see it lifted the pavement, so we're going to have to get around to repairing the pavement as well. Initially, we isolated Plant 1 to stop the flow. We were storing water for a time, but we had to respond quickly and put diesel bypass pumps in place to feed Plant 1. Plant 2 and 3 alone can't handle all the flow on a daily basis. So we did that, and we did some other very creative things within the plant to get water from one plant to an emergency basin where we could then pump it to Plant 1. So we're able to stabilize the facility, but again, we're running on diesel pumps every day, and we're doing these other things that are making it difficult to optimize the plant. But staff did a great job doing that and keeping the plant up, to keep up with the flows and keep us in compliance with discharge requirements. So we immediately called Falonk to come out and do the excavation where the leak was. You can see in the photograph there, that's what we found at this elbow, the crown of the pipe, corroded, and when we made the excavation, everything fell in. This is a 30-inch pipeline. This portion of the pipeline was constructed in the year 2000 when we installed Plant 2. This is what the inside looked like. When we saw the damage, we figured we wouldn't be able to just order a new elbow and install it and go back online. So this was part of the time we've spent since then, was to do some inspection of the pipeline, and we saw heavy corrosion from headworks to this point and even downstream of the leak. So we knew that the scope of this repair was going to be much larger than just patching the one hole. So as we began to come up with options, we saw it as two options. One was to remove the whole pipeline and replace it with a new one. This we figured would be very expensive. It would be very time-consuming. The plant's very congested with yard piping going all over the place. We'd have to do a lot of potholing, and it would be very difficult to excavate the pipeline and try and feed it above and below all the other lines and electrical duct tanks within the plant. So we spent some time assessing whether or not we could use cured-in-place pipe to line the pipeline, you know, replace the elbow, leave the rest of the pipeline in place, and use this as a repair method. So we haven't done this in the district before within the wastewater plant. So we took some time talking to these companies to figure it out, come up with a good scope of work. But in the end, we felt this would be the best way to go. The liner is resistant to the type of hydrogen sulfide corrosion. We also feed ferric chloride. That's an acidic chemical that can attack and degrade steel pipe. So this plastic is expected to resist that and be just as good as a new pipe and last for 40 years or more. So we developed a scope of work, which includes fabricating this elbow and installing it. We'll pull 288 feet of this liner from headworks all the way to plant one, and then we'll have to backfill and do site restoration. While this is a very urgent repair that we need to get done, as I described, due to the way we're having to operate the plant, it was stable, so we didn't want to take the full month and a half to do a full bid, but we did take the time to get quotes. And so you can see the result of that here. So Don Peterson was just slightly lower than Flonk at $122,000. And NorCal Pipeline, we found, gave a very competitive bid at about $110,000. So these are the costs and the estimate to date. At the top are expenses so far. But the item requiring ratification is to Don Peterson and NorCal Pipeline, the two line items on the bottom. We have already issued them the POs and contracts. They've mobilized and started the work. And we expect this to be done by May. And so the recommendation is to ratify and approve the contracts we've issued to Don Peterson and to NorCal Pipeline with a total project cost not to exceed $340,000.
Hey, Director Slauson?
Out of curiosity, so the cured-in-place pipe, is that cement?
It's a type of plastic and resin, so they'll pull it through the pipeline and then they blow it up and expand it out to take on the shape of the pipeline that's there. And then I think they'll be injecting steam, so the high temperature of the steam will cure the liner in place. And it'll actually have structural properties. So, you know, the old pipe can still have holes in it. You just need enough of the pipe to hold the liner. So it'll be structural, and it'll be resistant to the forms of corrosion we expect. So it should be a really good option. And we're actually, you know, in a way, we're kind of excited about it because as we begin or continue doing condition assessments in the other reclamation plants, this might be a very efficient way to rehabilitate a lot of the yard piping within the plants without, you know, doing months-long replacement projects that require a lot of expensive bypass pumping and things.
How thick is it?
You know, I'm not sure how thick the liner is. I think... It's on the order of 3/8 of an inch. The staff told me. I think it's about 3/8 of an inch.
Okay, so there's no capacity problem with the...
Right, and typically when we do something like this, you have the old pipeline at a very rough surface being cement-lined, whereas the plastic is very smooth, so the C factor usually makes up for that minor loss of diameter.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think to your point, Director Slauson, if we were to consider this type of repair in the future, we'd have to look at the hydraulic capacity of the pipe, make sure that by consuming that thickness that we're not in any way going to undermine. But you're absolutely right. In other applications I've seen, that is a factor in terms of you look at the hydraulic capacity, recognizing that you are going to lose it a little bit. In this particular application, it's not going to be an issue for us.
Yeah, and we did look at the hydraulics. We'll make up for the loss of area.
Right. Yeah, engineering did take a look at the hydraulics of this line as well, especially since it's a low head gravity line. And in this application, it works out as well.
It sounds like a great alternative.
Well, if it's low head, it really doesn't have to be smooth at that, you know, at the end of the line. I mean, at the end of the line, I mean, you're sliding in this liner, and you're injecting the a resin in between the liner and the pipe? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, this will be my first time witnessing it, but they pull it through. I think it's impregnated.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's already coated and soaked with the resin, so they pull it through, they expand it, and so they just pump the line full of steam, which then cures the chemicals and the resin and plastics and everything in place.
Well, actually, then the corrosion in the old pipe will help anchor that liner, because your resin's going to seep into those pockets and then adhere to the liner, and then, I mean, I think it's excellent.
Now, it's definitely a good solution for this application. I just want to clarify that the way this works, it's like a sock that you essentially unfold in the pipe and you expand via the water. But within the actual liner is the resin.
Okay.
It gets activated through the high heat in the water via the steam to heat the water. But it's essentially it's like a sock that you unfold within the pipe.
Yeah, this picture on the left, you know, that's a different kind of sewer, but yeah, they kind of pull it inside out and pull it through. And so in our case, you know, we're starting with a pipe like what's in the center, and then when we're done, it'll look like what's on the right.
Okay, well, take pictures.
Yes, we'll do.
Be interested to see.
Well, it's 30 inches. You could go in. You could go in and take the pictures.
Lost a couple pounds lately. I might get in there.
So I have no questions for you, but I would like the new person in charge of this. Are you okay with this? All right.
Sure.
With that, I will make a motion to pass the item. Second. Director Corona. May I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Melendez.
You.
With that concludes our action items. We're going to go for informational presentations this morning. One that I think we've all been looking forward to, at least I have, is our land secured financing program analysis. Thomas, are you going to lead us through this morning?
I am, yes. I have the
clever joke or pun involved at some point during the presentation.
Director Corona gave me a heads up in the break room.
All right.
So
all right.
See if I did a good job carving one in on the fly. Morning, President Pauly, members of the board. You know, I'm very excited for the opportunity to bring this item to the board, informational item. A lot of effort has gone into this. By way of background, over the course of last year, various discussions and comments were made at the board level as well as the executive level regarding CFDs and whether fees should be included as an eligible expense. In October, a request was made by the board for an analysis to be conducted, basically to determine if CFDs were detrimental to home buyers in our service area. I want to introduce, before I go any further, Jerry Nguyen from DTA, who is a firm that we engaged to assist us with the analysis. I'll discuss a few more additional information on DTA in a few slides, but wanted to make sure that we got the credit for bringing consultant here today. The Mello-Roos Facilities Act was passed in 1982 and provided a financing tool for public facilities and services to be financed
for homes that would serve to be benefited by those facilities and services, including street, water, sewer, and storm drain improvements, parks, schools, public buildings, and related impact fees. As of the most recent published report available from the state, over $13 billion in CFD bonds are outstanding and have been issued by over 300 local government agencies. The graph shows the total CFD bonds outstanding by year from 1995 to 2019. Following the Great Recession in the past 10 years, the amount of CFD bonds issued has grown exponentially. Southern California continues to lead the state in CFD bonds and CFD formations, and I believe it's really credited to the housing demand that Southern California has experienced over the last 10 years. 62% of the debt outstanding in the state has been issued by the five Southern California counties, or five of the Southern California counties. Riverside County being number one with the CFDs and debt outstanding. School districts within the county account for nearly 50% of the bonded CFDs, followed by special districts at 25%. Pointing your attention to the bar chart on the right has an expanded view of the special districts with Harupa Community Services District in the lead spot. This is as of fiscal year ending 2019, which was the most updated report available from the state. Knowing how busy and active Eastern has been, I'd likely expect or suspect that Eastern would be at the top, if not very close to it. Following the board's request in October, staff reviewed several qualified firms with extensive experience with local government agencies and land-secured financing. DTA, formerly known as David Tosic & Associates, was selected to conduct the analysis. The firm provides annual administration to over 3 million assessor parcels and also specializes in various impact reports, fiscal impact, economic impact analyses. Moreover, they have extensive, relevant, local experience. Because the firm hadn't worked with Eastern's financing team or has any vested interest in the land-secured financing program, they offer a unique and unbiased perspective to be able to perform this analysis and contributed to their selection. Andrea Ress, managing director at DTA, spearheaded the effort, but she was unable to attend as she's out of the country. As I mentioned, Jerry Nguyen, senior vice president with DTA, is here in person representing DTA and will be happy.
Much appreciated.
Very much appreciated, and he'll be available to answer any questions, should there be any. Based on the most updated information obtained from the California Debt and Investment Advisory Commission, or CDAC for short, the top CFD bond issuers were reviewed from 2016 to 2020, really to see if the allowed fees, 9 out of the 10 firm or agencies allow fees to be financed, with the one agency not allowing it being the city of Beaumont. Several years ago, as the city underwent widespread administrative and policy changes, they ultimately excluded fees from being financed. But prior to that, they did allow them. I see Director Slauson smiling, and I'll just say there was a thing called Beaumont Gate once upon a time, not too long ago. In addition to the top 10 issuers in the state, several other local agencies within Eastern's boundaries were also surveyed and found to also include fees as eligible expenses to be financed. DTA utilized information provided by the district and the County of Riverside to examine the residential homes built in a 10-year period from 2011 to 2020. 2021 numbers weren't available from the county, and so 2020 was the last full year of available information. This information was reviewed within Eastern's boundaries to determine whether those homes were built within a CFD led by EMWD, built within a CFD led by another agency, or built without a CFD at all. The table on this slide summarizes the results of those findings, and focusing your attention to the bottom two rows, nearly 21,900 homes were built during this 10-year period. 27% of the homes were included in an EMWD CFD. 62% of the homes were included in a CFD led by another agency, and approximately 11% of the homes were built without a CFD. Collectively, homes built within a CFD, whether led by EMWD or another agency, come to 89%. Shown in the image to the right, the parcels were mapped out to identify and visually review basically the disbursement of those homes within our service area. Of the homes built without a CFD, approximately 80% were non-adjacent parcels, likely built by an independent developer or a sole homeowner. Residential clusters were identified, six of them, of having more than 15 parcels as part of a neighborhood. Attached as an appendix to the presentation are maps with an expanded view by director division, with each of those six clusters identified. Of the six clusters, only one of them had more than 60 homes in the development. Fun fact, there are over 300 shades of green and over 100 shades of red. And for those wondering, yes, I chose the two shades representative of Christmas colors in April. And unfortunately, to my detriment, I think we're just a few days past being able to chalk it up to April Fools.
All right, you've hit your mark.
Okay. It was on the fly. I got 30 minutes to do it. Taking a closer look at the one residential development with more than 60 units is shown on this slide. Only one of the clusters built without a CFD would have qualified for a CFD, and it is shown here. This development is located within President Pauley's division, close to Highway 74 and Winchester Road in the unincorporated part of the county known as Winchester. Upon further review of this development, we found that it actually was an Eastern CFD formed in 2006, known as Winchester Trails. The development was originally planned for 217 homes. About 25% of those homes were developed and sold. But then in 2009, we received a request to dissolve the CFD due to economic conditions at the time, following Great Recession, and troubles of selling the homes. The property was later sold and developed by D.R. Horton in 2016-2017. We reached out to them to determine why a CFD wasn't later explored, because, you know, D.R. Horton is a developer that regularly forms CFDs with the district. They're, you know, known in this area. They build a lot of homes. They're very familiar with Eastern CFD programs. And it really boiled down to two reasons. The first of which being the original developer built a lot of the infrastructure and paid for the costs associated or that would have been financed through the CFD. The second reason, and I really want to point this out, is the original dissolution agreement with Eastern or between Eastern and the original developer. The original developer agreed to terms that a CFD wouldn't later be explored. D.R. Horton, out of good faith, honored that agreement and developed the property without a CFD and did not explore forming a CFD. So what we did, we looked at nearby CFDs in an effort to compare this 162-unit development, really to be able to compare a CFD versus a non-CFD home buying experience, if you will, for a homeowner, and the various impacts to them. Various factors made it very complex to make the comparison. I've listed them here. And because of the lack of neighboring CFDs and these factors, there was really a large discrepancy that was created within the variables, and a practical comparison was unable to be made. So what we did do was perform a comparative analysis with a CFD that recently issued bonds. CFD number 2016-74, Improvement Area B, consists of 218 homes and issued $6.6 million in bonds back in February. Assuming the developer, if a CFD wasn't created, would increase the cost of each home based on the amount financed through the CFD, if they did that on a pro rata basis across all of the homes, the per home increase would be approximately $30,000. Assuming both home buyers made the same down payment, received the same mortgage interest rate, the mortgage payment, including property taxes, insurance, the mortgage payment difference would be about $31 per month in favor of the CFD. Based on these assumptions, the key difference boils down to the home with no CFD being slightly more expensive, requiring a higher down payment, but paying less annual taxes. This same analysis was performed for several other CFDs, and the results were similar. No material impact to the homeowner, or home buyer, if you will, if purchasing the home with or without a CFD. A tax impact analysis was performed by DTA using the same CFD from the previous example. This analysis was performed in order to determine really the net impact to a homeowner based on property taxes, income taxes, and mortgage payment for a traditional family of four. The table in the bottom half of the slide summarizes the analysis, and based on conservative assumptions, the results of the analysis shows that there are marginal tax benefits to purchasing the home without a CFD. But the net benefit goes in favor of purchasing the home with a CFD to the tune of about $300. Now, each homeowner, income differences, tax situation, really individual homes, developments within our service area, areas, overlapping taxes, CFD or no CFD, would shift the variables quite considerably with each one. It's important to note that DTA is not a tax preparer firm, and I do not have a side gig preparing tax returns. So let the record show. We did our best to put this analysis together based on very conservative assumptions to show the net impact to a homeowner. I also want to point out the state and local taxes deduction limitation of $10,000. In this example, and several other examples that we ran through the analysis, the property taxes weren't enough to reach the threshold of the $10,000. And so neither home buyer in the various analyses were impacted by SALT deduction limitations. Also, upon reviewing IRS guidelines, the special taxes with the CFD are not eligible deductible expenses. Switching gears here, the next few slides cover Eastern CFDs in a little bit more detail. And this slide in particular summarizes Eastern's policy principles, which are safeguards put in place to protect various stakeholders of the district. I'll highlight just a few notable ones and then make a connection to them in just a few slides. But developers are required to pay in advance for formation costs, and this ensures that Eastern's ratepayers don't pay for the administrative time and expenses required or conducted in order to form CFDs. Growth pays for gross. Growth pays for growth, as they say. Focusing your attention to the special tax ratepayer protection, Eastern CFDs, per our debt policy, the special tax will not escalate for those, and the effective tax rate must be below 2% at the time of bond sale. This is to ensure that the special taxes remain affordable and don't create a lack of affordability for the homes or the debt that's issued to finance these infrastructure costs. Since 2001, EMWD has formed 65 CFDs, encompassing 105 total improvement areas. As you could see, from 2001 to 2005, CFD activity was pretty substantial. 2006 and 5-6 years after that, with the housing market crash, Great Recession, really stayed flat, remained stagnant, and then picked up as the economy recovered, house prices stabilized, and then since then, we've been pretty steady. Now, we looked at the CFD usage, or homes built within a CFD, from 2011 on, and the homes built in that period really resulted from CFDs that were previously formed that weren't built because of really the housing market crash and lack of development activity in our area. So on this graph, where it becomes flat in 2006, the homes built in 2010, 11, and 12 really resulting from CFDs formed prior. Focusing your attention to the donut at the bottom slide really shows what has been funded in the last 10 years since 2012. Bulk of the amount financed has been fees, 55% of $140 million, followed by about 25% in EMWD facilities, and then other agencies' fees and facilities through JCFA agreements on Eastern-led CFDs. Speaking of JCFAs, we started entering into JCFAs in the late 1990s. Since then, we've entered into 155. I've summarized some key bullet points here or charts here showing top school districts and cities that we've formed that we've entered into JCFAs with. More importantly, we took a diverse sample of 30% of the JCFAs that we've entered into, looked at what those CFDs that were formed by other agencies and what they financed relative to Eastern's charges, and 94% financed fees and 6% facilities were financed. A bulk of them, as you could see, really were the Eastern fees. A final analysis was performed comparing a CFD led by led by EMWD in comparison to a CFD led by another agency. Most other agencies allow for their special taxes to escalate, and as I mentioned before, Eastern prohibits that per our debt policy. As property taxes increase, escalating special taxes also increase, and Eastern's special tax will stay stable and is shown in this somewhat busy graph, but it's shown in the dark blue bars. In green are the non-EMWD CFDs with the 2% escalator, which across the board is what they use with the assumption that ad valorem tax also grows at 2%. Over time, over 30 years, a traditional mortgage, you can see that that delta really widens and increases, and ultimately, in this example, comes to about a $40,000 difference. In other words, EMWD is better to lead the CFD, not only because of our strong, mature program, but also because the impact to the homeowner is beneficial with a non-escalating special tax. In summary, CFDs in the state, very popular. The last 10 years, grown exponentially. In Southern California, with Southern California leading the state, there's really not a whole lot of options, especially in our service area, for home buyers to purchase a home without a CFD. A bulk of the CFDs are not led by Eastern, but we do have a fair share of the CFDs. Because of our debt policy, because of our experience program, hiring the right consultants, helping us with financing, and some of the strict requirements of our debt policy, the Eastern-led CFDs really serve to benefit home buyers in our service area if we're able to lead as many CFDs as possible. If we were to exclude fees, which would be somewhat out of the norm based on the top 10 issuers and local agencies, most of the CFDs that we lead would be then led by another agency, subject to their agency's policies, goals, procedures, and practices. And so it's really the position of the financing team and my position that Eastern is best led or best to serve as a lead agency on as many CFDs as we can. That wraps up my presentation. There was a lot to unpack here, and I'd be happy to answer any questions from the board.
I'm almost certain we have some questions and comments, and if we could, since you came out here, would you want to come up and answer any questions? Or okay, I again appreciate when people come to our meetings, and so we're going to give them a little bit of spotlight. But Director Armstrong, do you comments or questions on this item?
Yeah, I just wanted to start with thanking the staff for this is a really thorough effort, and I think it's as thorough as you can do on analyzing this, and also thank them for updating me along the way and getting my thoughts and getting me educated as well. And I guess since Jerry is up there, I thought you're supposed to bring the consultant before you spend the money, not afterwards. But I think that going through this and seeing the final results, it's very complicated. And my concern of this, because I've had a concern, was that we're not going to burden our customers and our property owners within our service area at the expense of profits to, you know, developers. And that's really been what my concern is. And so, you know, this analysis is done as good as you can do to look at, you know, CFD versus non-CFD to see if you can isolate that or not. And it's a really hard thing to do. But the reason why is I just hate to see our customers be burdened, and then they're going to be our customer, and they're going to have to pay these property assessments. They're going to have to pay our water bills. We're going to compete for tax bonding, availability, and et cetera, and all those things. And so, again, I had a concern about it. This has really helped me tremendously. I think one of the other things that I don't know if you mentioned this specifically, but when you look at the fees, and it's the fees that I had a concern about, is that there's the real potential that if we took our fees out, another agency would lead this, and there would be more fees that are just put in that are being excluded because of our 2% cap. So it's really one way or the other, they're going to be in there. And so knowing that, I think it's more important to, and it's a better protection for our customers if we do lead the CFDs because of we do have a 2% cap. We do have the no escalation clause in there, and we do a great job, and we have a great team, and we get the best rates on the financing, et cetera. So for me, it's helped me to see that this is a good program that we have at Eastern and one that we need to continue and need to support. The last comment I have is just that I think that having such a program like this and an impact like this, I think it's important periodically to look at these types of programs, and as time goes by, to double and check back in and make sure that it is still appropriate program. And so I appreciate that you took the time to do this, and it just kind of confirms that this has been a good program, you know, since it's been implemented. And yeah, so thank you.
No, and thank you. Without your feedback, your interest over the last year, you know, you can make the argument this wouldn't have been done. And when we started it, you know, I didn't realize or know as much as I do now, learning and, you know, setting up really benchmarks on what to look for, really having an understanding of our service area and the activity performed within there. And so, you know, I really appreciate all your great questions, your insight, and your feedback as we navigated through this somewhat, you know, gray area in our service area.
If I can just add, just to echo Thomas's comments, I think late last year when we heard the inquiries from the board, we embarked on this effort. And what we found out very quickly is no one else has been looking at this, these series of questions. It was kind of interesting. We reached out to other water districts, to other agencies that sponsor CFDs. So I think the questions that this board posed to us late last year were very unique, and we embarked on a very, I would say, insightful effort to truly understand the program, the nuances of the program, and ultimately what we saw is the benefits of our program to our ratepayers. So it was very innovative work, and you know, I'm sure there will be a lot of interest in what we found with others who sponsor CFDs, and we'll be happy to share this work with others. But I do want to also extend my appreciation to Director Armstrong, because he did participate in several meetings along the way to provide his feedback to us as we develop this effort. So it's been a good effort to truly take a deep dive in understanding our CFD program.
Director Slauson.
Yeah, I would say it was a good effort that we did. I appreciate that. If we just assumed that it's fine, let's not worry about it, let's not look into it, we never would learn that, whether or not it truly was, and we would be closed. And it's a good thing Matt isn't closed to discussions, because he has a new pipeline refurbishment program. And if we were blind to that, then we wouldn't have that opportunity. I did have a question, though. How is that structured when they escalate it? I mean, how do they do that differently than when you don't escalate it?
I'll take it, and then okay. Maybe, Jerry, if I miss anything, you can add to it. So when CFD capacity, when financing amount is calculated, really, you know, prior to bonds being issued, what they do is they look at the total revenue over the 30 years and then size to that capacity to issue bonds with a debt schedule that could be paid by those revenues. When they do it with Eastern, when they project those special taxes, they don't add the escalator, and so it really caps what is issued. When they do it for another agency, school district, city, that allows an escalator, when they project those revenues, they'll add a 2% escalator, which increases the total amount that the debt can afford with the payment schedule, and they're able to issue more debt and map out what that project special tax would be.
So is their payment lower at the beginning?
No. So on this example, in year one, both CFD examples are sized to the maximum of 2%. So they're both issuing enough debt, okay. And then based on a single homeowner, the debt or the special tax is the same. In this example, $3,800 on a yearly basis. Moving forward, Eastern's tax in the light blue box on the very right side in year 30, Eastern's tax is still $3,800, whereas a CFD led by another agency on that home is $6,800. And so their tax will escalate, and that's really determined prior to bonds being issued to size to that capacity.
And Thomas, I'd add, it's just the agency's board approves those policies. So if the board approves a 2% escalator, that will be in the policy and the agreements.
Yes, in their debt policy.
If I was the homeowner, I'd prefer the $300 a month, because in 30 years, $300 a month would not be very much money.
So just to piggyback on Thomas' comment on the 2%. So what the statute allows is you are allowed to either have a level or up to in annual escalator up to 2%. So you can do a 1% or 1.5%. And also from the bonding perspective, what you do is you look at your annual maximum special tax that could be generated within the CFD. And basically what they want is what the marketplace, what the investor want is they want at least 110% debt service coverage. And that basically says, if you take your maximum special tax revenue, if you take out what your administrative expense is going to be, and then divide that by the debt service for that year, it had to be at least 110% each year. So by building the maximum allowable 2% escalator, what it does is you basically increase your special tax revenue by 2% on an annual basis, and that allow your debt service to also pretty much increase by 2%. And therefore, that dramatic, that really increase your mounting capacity by a fairly significant amount.
Thank you.
Yeah, really good report. I really enjoyed it. I think there's a lot that you guys brought into this that, you know, I didn't know, and I thought it was just super interesting. I want to thank Director Armstrong for being very persistent on this, because I think it kind of opened our eyes a little bit more about how the whole process works and everything. So, I was I was for these things beforehand, and I'm even more stronger in favor of them now. And so I, you know, Eastern does a great job on these types of deals, and I'm glad that we're just going to continue doing them. And now we've got Jeff on board all the time now, so I'm happy.
Yeah, and I'll just chime in again. Thank you, Director Armstrong, for bringing this forward. It's always good to have new information, and I'll kind of tell you why. Director Slauson and I have been around here long enough to remember when we got ourselves in a little bit of CFD issues during the Great Recession. And so the board came up with some new policies. I think it's, what do we have, Thomas? What's the minimum, 125?
Yeah, last year when we when the board adopted the new debt policy, we lowered it to 100, but require an additional reserve for developments between 100 and 150, just for the health of the CFD and the homeowners.
So my point being that, yes, it's very good to review these and ask questions all the time, so because these are always changing targets on the economy. But since we have an expert in front of me right now, you've reviewed our CFD policy. Do you, in your opinion, feel that's a solid policy to protect the ratepayers in the district?
Yes, I do think so. I think the 4.1 borrowing-to-lean ratio, that's a really good starting point, because the statute only requires 3-to-1, and then the 4-to-1 really give that extra protection to the homeowner. I think the no escalating debt service, which is really limited to how much that special tax can escalate or the impact on the homeowner going forward basis, and I do think the staff is really knowledgeable in terms, and I have been working with a lot of, you know, public agency, and Thomas specifically was super knowledgeable. So I think district is have a very great asset in the staffing in terms of their knowledge about the CFD. I think the fact that, you know, Director Armstrong now is on the board, who is kind of being watching this whole process, that will make sure that the EMWD going forward will be a really great agency to work with in terms of protecting the consumers within the district.
Let me ask you one more question as the expert in this area. How often do you think a public agency like ours should review the CFD policy? Every 5 years, every 7 years, every 10 years?
Well, I think it really just depends on your, I think every 5 years, I think is a good start. I think it's also depending on your, environment. If you have a lot of CFD, petition, and then, so it's something that I think is, I think is a play by year. I think that the district does have a very solid policy. But, and then maybe sometime, when you need to do, a development requires some facility that need to be built before they can commence development. You may not have that 4.1 volume to lean ratio may not necessarily be achieved. So is it the district's, does the district have some leeway to maybe lower that ratio as on a needy basis? Because if without that facility, they cannot develop. And so that's something that the board can kind of think about. Is this something that they want to have some leeway to maybe to allow for some special case scenario to make some adjustment to the debt policy, to the CFD goals and policies?
Very good. Well, again, great discussion. We are. I don't see growth slowing down in our service areas, so I think this has been very healthy for both the board and the district to go through this exercise. And thank you again for coming out in person today. Appreciate it very much.
It's a good day to come out.
Very good. With that, why don't we take about a 7 or 8 minute break? We could reconvene. I believe we are up to informational item B, which is the Metropolitan Water District fiscal budget and rates update. And Joe, are you going to give this?
I am, President
Pauly. Fantastic.
Good morning again, members of the board. This is obviously a team effort. Several of us here have been engaged with Director Records in this process that is taking place at Metropolitan Water District. As you're aware, as Director Record and staff have provided updates in the past several months, Metropolitan is going through its budget development process and proposed rates for the next biennium. Today, we wanted to share with you an update on where that process stands, some of the information that has been shared with us, and also would welcome your feedback because this is ultimately culminating in a item that will be presented to the Finance Committee next week, as well as potentially a vote by the Metropolitan Board on the recommended budget and rate increases. So we definitely want to get your feedback on where this is headed as well. So with that, in terms of background, as I mentioned, Metropolitan adopts a new budget and rates every 2 years. If you recall back in late 2019, Metropolitan decided to suspend collection of the water stewardship rates due to the ongoing litigation with the San Diego County Water Authority. And as you recall, that rate funds demand management. When that occurred, the biennium of the time for 2021 and 2022, the rates increases were 3% and 4% respectively. At the time, Metropolitan provided a 10-year forecast of what the rate increases would look like, and they estimated a 5% going forward. So we, along with many other member agencies, utilized that projection to factor into our budgets and rates on a going forward basis. Having said that, recently there was a court decision that clearly decided that demand management cost would be incorporated as part of a water supply rate component. If you recall, previously, prior to that decision, demand management costs were part of the transportation or conveyance component. Based on the recent workshops that have been held at Metropolitan initially put forward a budget and rate increases of 8% for each year for the next 2 years. And there's been an awful lot of conversation and discussion about that proposal. So there's been several workshops. Specifically, there's been 4 workshops that have been held to date, starting in early February. During those workshops, Metropolitan staff have essentially presented the proposed budget and the rate increases, initially the 8%, 8%. Their rationale is that out of that 8%, there's 5% associated with the reinstatement of the water stewardship rate and 3% to address inflationary pressures, including increases in power cost, as well as chemicals and labor cost. That was the basis of their initial proposed budget and rate increases. Having said that, there's been a lot of feedback provided to the Metropolitan team, and I'll get into the specific feedback that was received at the March 22nd board meeting. And as I mentioned, that the last bullet point is that this item will be going forward on April 11th with a detailed discussion, as well as potentially a vote on April 12th at the board level. So workshop one in February, and I've had conversations with both the Metropolitan CFO as well as the Metropolitan General Manager about the proposed budget. Both of them have indicated, both in my discussions as well as in the workshops, that they believe this budget is transitionary. And what is meant by that is they strongly believe that the current rate structure, in their opinion, is not sustainable. And this has been the case for many years at Metropolitan in terms of the expenditures are primarily fixed whereas the revenue is primarily variable. So as agencies develop their local resources, as they essentially reduce their purchases from Met, that reduces revenue, but yet the expenditures are primarily fixed. So there is this inverse relationship between primarily fixed expenditures versus variable revenues. In fact, Metropolitan is projecting lower sales over the next couple of years than what they had previously projected. And they did an analysis that showed that 100,000 acre feet less volumetric sales would result in a 6.5% rate increase on top of what they're considering. So it's a fairly volatile rate structure. And I think that is what they mean by this next 2 years needs to be a transition as we engage in a broader conversation with the other member agencies. Now, clearly, there are those agencies like us who believe that the rate structure is inappropriate given the current conditions. But there are other agencies that feel that the rate structure is just fine the way it is. So it's going to be an interesting and challenging conversation if we're able to get there. In addition to the lower transactions, Metropolitan has also asked that the initial budget at least included 20 new positions. They also had identified the need for an additional 81 positions, primarily in operations and engineering. Those were identified as part of the unfunded priorities, meaning they were not part of the 8% and 8%. And I'll show you later what that would translate to. Also, the general manager had put together a strategic plan, and that's not final yet. It's close to being finalized, but the budget includes some of those priorities. And in this initial budget and rate projection, they also forecast 5% increase for the subsequent years between 2025 to 2032. The budget also includes a $600 million capital plan for the next 2 years. Significant amount of projects, including projects to improve water supply resiliency to those member agencies that are exclusively reliant on the state water project. And demand management is a significant factor in this budget. Metropolitan is proposing to more than double the budget for demand management and conservation. So the options that were initially put forward, as I mentioned, the first option was an 8% and 8% rate increase over the next 2 years. This would constitute a reinstatement of the 5% associated with the water stewardship rate. If you recall, when that was suspended, essentially Met was using the water stewardship reserve fund to fund those obligations for LRP and other obligations. Having said that, when you look at this table, what you'll note is the 8% represents a overall increase. If you drill down and look at the full service untreated rate of Tier 1 as well as the full service treated, there it's actually a little higher. It's 10% and 9%. Those are the figures that we would use to understand the impacts on our purchased water as we purchase both untreated as well as treated water from Metropolitan at the Tier 1 level. The next option would essentially fund the 81 positions that I mentioned earlier. These were presented as additional needs by the Metropolitan staff, and that would result in a higher rate increase the first year of overall 9%, and the second year would be 8%. As I'll get into later, one thing that was clear to us and to other member agencies, currently Met has about 9 to 10% vacancies within their workforce being approximately 1,900 employees. So they have about 180 vacant positions due to retirements. And these additional positions would be on top of filling those vacancies. So as you'll see later, what we believe needs to occur and what some of the feedback provided to Met is they need to come up with a budget that accounts for the reality that's going to take time to fill those vacancies, those 180 positions, as well as any potential future positions. Not to say that we're suggesting they reduce the authorized positions, but just a more realistic budget, recognizing that there will likely be more retirements as they start coming back to the office. In fact, they just started this week returning the Metropolitan staff to the offices. And then the third option that was laid out was a 7% and 7% rate increase. And under this assumption, or I should say this scenario, they would bond finance conservation, and they would essentially spread the cost. The rationale being that the beneficiaries of conservation are not just current ratepayers, but future ratepayers as well. So that's what they're proposing. They're also proposing, instead of the 20 positions, they would add a total of 40 positions, meaning a portion of the 20 initial positions identified as well as the 20 from the unfunded priorities. I should mention that all of these options did not get traction at the last workshop, meaning that there was a lot of concern expressed by a number of member agencies. There were also comment letters submitted from the City of Pasadena, Otay Water District, and County Water Authority. You know, our comments have been made to not only the staff at MET, to the general manager and the CFO, but at these workshops we've indicated that we believe, for example, the City of Pasadena's letter was compelling. I think they identified some options that Metropolitan staff need to consider in trying to put forward a lower rate increase proposal. So some of the feedback, as I mentioned, there was pushback associated with the 8% and 8%. And again, some of the agencies, especially the cities, have utilized the 5% projection for their budgets, and it's hard for them, it's very difficult to react to the higher rate increases as far as their budget, and just they don't have sufficient time. Having said that, I think we all understand there's inflationary pressures. I think we're all seeing that. We're all seeing higher power cost, higher chemical cost, and you know, inflation is real, and we're you know, it's impacting I think everyone's budgets accordingly. But we think there are options for Metropolitan staff to go back and revisit their proposed budget as well as rate increases, and there are some discretionary items, and specifically the discretionary items that MET staff, I believe, can go back and take a look at are the staffing budget, in terms of the vacancies and the need to budget for those vacancies, at coming up with a more realistic plan, and possibly developing a ramp up accordingly. That could reduce the rate increases by 1-2% if done effectively. Also, the other discretionary item is demand management. Should Metropolitan, given the reduced sales, continue to move ahead with doubling, the conservation budget? Should they seek state funding for conservation demand management, given the obviously this is an issue for the entire state? So that was suggested as well. The other thing that I'll get into later is perhaps MET should consider a temporary suspension of new commitments under the LRP program. Obviously, MET needs to honor its current obligations under the LRP, but given where we are today and given the fact that member agencies continue to essentially roll off of MET, should MET be funding those future LRP commitments? Perhaps there needs to be a temporary suspension until a more comprehensive financial plan is developed. So that was our suggestion as well at the last workshop. So with that background, our finance team did go back and look at the potential cost impact on EMWD. We initially looked at the base proposal of 8% and 8%. And this, if this were to be approved by the Metropolitan Board, it would impact 6 months of our fiscal budget. We operate on a July 1st to end of June basis, whereas this increase would be effective as of January 1st. And it would affect us the initial year during the time where we would traditionally purchase less water from MET versus the summer months. So the 2022-2023 fiscal budget impact on EMWD, if the 8% rate increase were to be adopted, would be on the order of about $1.3 million. If that were to occur, our suggestion to this board, our recommendation would be that we can absorb that from our operating reserves. We would not be seeking a mid-cycle rate adjustment at this time. Having said that, the 8% rate increase the second year would have a greater impact on us, and it would equate to approximately $4.7 million above what we budgeted. So we don't have the rates established yet for 2024. As you're aware, we just are embarking on a cost of service study to help us understand where our proposed budget rates will be. So whatever ultimately is decided by the Metropolitan Board as far as rate increase, that will be incorporated as part of the cost of service study, and we'll be back in front of this board with recommendations accordingly. But we at least wanted you to be aware of what that initial 8% would look like for the second year. So when you look at these three options that I described earlier, the impacts, although they may appear limited to about 900,000 to 1.8 the first year, they dramatically increase the second year, depending upon which option is considered, possibly up to 3.5 million to 5.7 million, depending upon which one of these options. Now, as I mentioned, none of these options were well received by the eight member agencies, and there was significant pushback. And basically, Met staff was asked to go back and come up with an alternative that would be a lower rate increase. So the lower rate increase that Met staff is going to look at, and we have not seen those details, we believe will be in the range of 5.5% to possibly 6 or 6.5%. We believe that is the option that they will introduce next week. And we have looked at that scenario and what does that mean to EMWD's budget. I just want to clarify that we believe they're going to be able to get down to the lower rate increase of 5.5 to 6.5 by looking at the vacancy rate, by not budgeting the entire labor budget that they were seeking previously. Also, I believe they need to revisit the demand management budget and consider a potential temporary suspension of the LRP. Although we support that, and we made it clear that we would support such a move, other agencies do not. So it's going to be interesting conversation at the finance and board meetings next week. But I believe if the board wants to see a lower rate increase for the next 2 years, there's going to have to be difficult decisions made at Metropolitan. With that said, if you look at the table at the bottom, that illustrates what this will translate to financially to us if there's a 5.5 versus 6 versus 6.5 rate increase at Met. Regardless of that range of where ultimately it lands, first year, again, our recommendation will be whether it's the $300,000 impact or greater, we would propose to utilize operational reserves. Second year, you'll see the budget impacts there, somewhere between just under 900,000. This is above, again, what we budgeted to possibly $2.6 million. We would obviously, we recommend going with a lower rate structure within this range versus the originally proposed 8%, or even higher, 9%. So our recommendation to this board is that we support a lower rate increase, a lower budget, knowing there's going to be a difficult conversation, difficult decisions, but that would be our recommendation. I know Director Record is interested to hear from the entire board on where we stand and, frankly, staff's recommendation on this. And as I mentioned, Laura, John, and Jolene and myself have all been very much engaged with Director Record on these discussions that have occurred at Metropolitan. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Questions?
I have.
Director Armstrong?
Yeah, no, I mean, just more comments, I guess. I mean, I know there's rate pressures, and you don't want to get behind on keeping up with those pressures. I remember maybe a decade or so ago, it was like, I think, a surprise 19-20-something% increase that nobody had really anticipated. And, so when you're forecasting 5% and staying around there, that's much more manageable for agencies to deal with. But I think, you know, as a member agency, I appreciate that you and Director Record are giving ideas and suggestions and looking at things and helping provide MET staff alternatives to look at. And so I think that's great, and I support, you know, the direction that you're heading and the effort that you're trying to get something lower than the 8 or 9 or 10% down there. But you know, a 5% increase, I think that's a pretty fair, reasonable expectation in today's market, and especially with the level of demand potentially dropping, and I know this, that creates more pressure for them. So,
I appreciate that, Dr. Armstrong. And to your point, one of the scenarios which I didn't show that Matt presented was, you know, with their current budget, if they were to reduce first year rate increase to 3%, the second year would have to go up to 13%. So obviously that's not going to work. There have to be difficult decisions, as I mentioned, on the budget to try to look at those discretionary costs. One thing we've heard, again, we haven't seen their alternative proposal, but we've heard that they're going to try to come down to the 5.5, as I mentioned, to the 6.5 range. But the subsequent years, instead of being 5%, they may have to smooth out or pop up to about 6%. So essentially you're trying to smooth out those costs in a more gradual fashion than having these you're right. Historically, they've had the rate spikes. Yeah. But there were years, many years, when Met did not have any rate increases at all. So it is important to have rate adjustments, but it's got to be balanced. It's got to be smoothed out over time. From my perspective, beyond the initial 2 years, there's still a number of unknowns that could impact Metropolitan's rates. The proposed Carson plant is only partly funded in terms of planning through these rates. I know Metropolitan is seeking federal and state funding. But until we collectively figure out how are we going to fund the Carson plant and how are we going to fund other initiatives, what's the future of the LRP program, I think there's a number of unknowns down the road. For that reason, I think it's better to take a more modest rate increase right now and then over the next couple of years work on these other issues.
Dr. Schlossen?
Certainly, I agree with what you're proposing, that you're going to continue to work on the different aspects, and especially keeping their rate lower, their increase lower. But it's not surprising to me. I know we've discussed it, and we knew this was coming, maybe up to 8% for several years. But considering the rate of inflation right now, if they can, and they're going to expand with that, I'm sure they have other pressures, financial pressures with inflation. If we, because the amount we have to pass on to a ratepayer, if we keep it under 2%, but we're going to have additional costs increasing this year. So it'll be more than 2%. We'll have to pass that along. But if I, as a consumer, if I read that EMWD was going to increase their rate by 5% after knowing that the, you know, CPI is 7 or 8, I would not be surprised. I'd say, well, that's justifiable. That's not to say we shouldn't continue to keep it as minimal as possible.
And Dr. Sawson, I agree. I think we're all seeing record-setting inflation, at least record-setting in the past more than a decade or so. One thing I should note that is a factor in the Metropolitan budget, energy costs, power costs is a big factor. One of the changes that they are implementing in their budget is they're recognizing that the state water project, whether it's this year or potentially the next couple of years, there may not be a whole lot of water available in terms of allocation. That is the more energy-intensive imported water supply is a state water project. So they are trying to calibrate their energy budget knowing that we may not have high allocations. But what is interesting is Metropolitan is leaning heavily in utilizing their storage, whether it's Diamond Valley Lake or other storage. This budget doesn't account for replenishment of that storage. Down the road, they're going to have to replenish the storage that we are all utilizing to get us through this current drought. So that's not financially factored in yet, but I just wanted to make you aware of it.
I have one other question, or a question. The engineering news record, how is that, you know, they monitor the increase for construction costs, engineering costs? Is there anything? They do it monthly, I think.
Yeah, they do, and I'll have to look at L.A. County. I mean, it varies by region, but it's not different than what you were describing in terms of the, you know, I'll have to get the exact number for LA County, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's in the range that you were describing earlier. Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said. I'd like to see no increase at all, but, you know, it is what it is. I did have a question about what was talked about at yesterday's meeting and the voting structure at Met and how it's weighted, and there are certain folks that, you know, don't get hardly any water, or at least not what we get, and then, but they have much more voting power at Met than we do, and how that fits in here. I mean, are we going to sit there and wait for the city of Los Angeles to decide everything that everybody else is going to do, or what?
Yeah, you bring up a valid and interesting issue, Dr. Corona. You're right. You know, we've had, to some degree, those conversations with Met, at least with the Met management team. We believe not only does the rate structure need to be revisited, but frankly, the voting structure at Met, in our opinion, is somewhat antiquated. It was established with the formation of Met in 1928 based on property valuation. So that is how everyone's weighted vote is. Now, granted, we are a growing region. We are a growing agency. So our share will increase as property values increase. But to the point I think you were speaking to, there's a number of agencies that over the years have developed their own local resources, and they purchase significantly less water from Met, but yet they still exercise a significant voted weight at Metropolitan, much greater than, say, EMWD when they purchase a fraction of what we purchase from Metropolitan. So that inequity, we believe, should be addressed. Now, there will be agencies who have that weighted vote and are using essentially Metropolitan as a peaking system or the system that they can rely on in case they have interruption. So not sure exactly where, you know, those conversations will lead, but I think to your point, absolutely, we believe the weighted vote structure that was established back in the 1920s is not reflective of the current realities that we're working with.
Yeah, because the when you think about it, then that was part of the discussion yesterday, was, you know, kind of a property value weighted system, and at the same time, you know, they kind of get rid of the ad valorem part of it, where, you know, the properties that have a lot of value are contributing more and helping to pay for that the rates and stuff. And then they get rid of that, but they still have the voting power. So they get rid of their contribution, and they're only, like you said, they're using it to peak, but then they have control of everything else through that voting power. It's kind of an unfair type of deal. But I don't see how that. As long as the same people are controlling the vote, I don't know how that would ever change.
And my hope is that if and when we embark on a conversation about the rate structure and the need to have the revenues primarily based on a fixed revenue, I think it goes to some degree to the point that you're making, Dr. Corona, because we believe currently having the overwhelming majority of revenue based on volumetric transactions is a highly volatile configuration. And we believe it needs to shift to a more fixed, based on benefits derived from Met, not simply the amount of water you're purchasing from Met.
Yeah.
And Director Corona, I'd offer, too, that, you know, it's important to remember Metropolitan is a creature of statute. And so there's likely to be, there have to be some kind of Sacramento involvement here, I think, if we're going to make that fundamental change to the voting structure.
Good luck.
And I would obviously agree. I think the governance structure of Met needs to be looked at and changed. It's it is a bit antiquated given today's environment. But I will obviously support whatever Director Record wants to do, his recommendations. I think we're very blessed to have him as part of our agency here, given his knowledge and influence at Met. So, but it is concerning. Back-to-back 8% increases. I mean, at some point, we need to figure out how that translates into the messaging for our customers, our ratepayers. And I'd like to also add, though, that, you know, recently we started having kind of informal discussions with some of our local other agencies about how to develop new local resources for us. So as the Met water gets more expensive for, as you know, reasons that Director Corona brought up, maybe a governance, maybe folks controlling Met that don't have our best interests at heart, I want to continue to look at how we develop our own local resources here, what we could do, some outside-the-box thinking to – we're never going to roll off of Met. We're never going to not be part of Met. But if we can control our own water destiny here via both supply and cost, I think we need to look at those options going forward. So very informative, but I would support whatever Director Record and you have as recommendations.
Thank you, President Pauly. And I do appreciate all the feedback that we received this morning from the board. We will definitely circle back with Director Record and have that conversation ahead of the anticipated vote at Met next week. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. That will bring us to item 6 on our agenda, which is to receive and file various reports. I'll make the motion to do so. Director
Second.
And Director Corona beat you to it.
All right.
So Director Corona
poor
seconded.
Jeff, he hasn't had those opportunities to.
I know. So may I get a roll call vote, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 4-2-0 with Director Record absent. We will go to our calendar review. Good morning, Jennifer.
Morning, President Pauly and members of the board. I have four events for your consideration today. The first one is the Temecula Valley Chamber of Commerce has a legislative summit that is going to be next Tuesday, April 12th, and that is from 7 to 10 a.m. at South Coast Winery. So if anybody is interested, please let me know. EMWD does have 7 seats available for that one. The second event is the Southern California Water Coalition quarterly luncheon. That one is going to be held at Wilson Creek. That is on the 22nd of April. EMWD is a sponsor, and we actually, due to sponsorship and membership, have 15 seats for that, so there's plenty of seating. So please let me know if you're interested. The third one is the State of the City Address for the City of Temecula. EMWD, again, is a sponsor for this event, and it will be on Thursday, May 12th at Pechanga Resort. There are 8 seats available for this one. And then lastly is the Inland Southern California United Way Gala. That is going to be at the University of Redlands on a Saturday, May 14th, from 6 to 10 p.m., and we are a sponsor for a table of 8. So.
And Jennifer, I would add, we've been partnering with United Way on the Help to Others program that the board is very familiar with.
Could you go ahead and put me down for one of those seats on the
sure.
United Way one? Because I do want to have Eastern represented there because of our partnership with them. So
perfect. So, and then on page 2 is the board's master calendar. Please let me know if you have any changes or additions to your schedules for the upcoming weeks. And then on page 3 is the conferences and events that are show the staff participation. As you may see, the beginning of May, we have the Aqua Spring Conference and CS Week, which is the same week as the first board meeting for the board, May 4th. Staff is today recommending that we cancel the May 4th board meeting and move all items to May 18th. Due to the conflicting schedules of staff absence.
Is that going to cause a very large meeting in May, or can we manage
that? No, we'll manage through that, President Pauly. I've worked with the team to look at each item that was previously identified for May 4th. We, of course, we want to make sure the board is comfortable with that recommendation, but we're able to accommodate.
Okay. No, I am. I know I'm going with Belor to Arizona for the customer service award, and some people are going to Aqua, so I'm good with it. I don't know if anybody else has opinions.
Fine. Yeah. Fine.
Sounds like we're good with that.
Oh. Right. Thank you.
Okay, and then continuing on for the rest of the committee meetings, just please note that for May's administrative committee meeting, that has been moved to Tuesday, May 10th. Otherwise, all other meetings are set and scheduled. And then lastly, on page 4 are the interagency meetings detailed April through June, in which next week's Elsinore Valley is a virtual meeting, not in person. So
that was at their request, correct?
Correct.
Thanks.
So I won't be attending the WRCOG dinner this year, and the reason is because I have to watch my son, and it's because my wife's going to Paris for 10 days, and she says it's for a Christian assembly women thing. I tell people she's shopping.
So she's going here?
Oh,
the real Paris.
The other Paris.
Oh, the
A-R-I-S.
Paris.
10 days in downtown Paris.
I know. My son and I are going to gain weight.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer. Excellent job, as usual. We will go to Director's Attendance Reports. Director Armstrong, would you like to lead us off, please?
Yeah. So let's see. I attended the Cal DSL Executive Committee meeting. There's a new executive director at Cal DSL, and I think he's doing a really good job. And one of the updates was that South Coast Water DSL project was passed the hurdle with the Regional Water Board, and so that's moving forward. It now go to the Coastal Commission sometime in summer, I think, or shortly after summer. But the general manager and I, we talked about this at our lunch the other day, and it sounds like you might have had another conversation with Matt. And I know you have a certain element and concern that you would like to see met in order for us to consider participating in that project. And I know you got to have some time to figure that out, but I really think that this is a project that's moving forward. It's been a decade or so in the making. There's South Coast Water owns property. They have pipelines. They have facilities. They've received grants. The cost of this desal, if it occurs this way, is substantially less than other desal projects that we've seen. And, you know, the idea of just dipping our toe in the water and participating at some small level, you know, this is like a real opportunity, I think, if it meets certain conditions that, you know, that you're looking at. But it's moving forward. And I just think that we should bring something back on this to the board to really consider if we want to move forward with this at some level or not, you know, soon before we miss an opportunity. So I was kind of hoping that, you know, when you get an answer from Met, maybe you could bring something back as an action that we could all talk about.
No, absolutely, Director Armstrong. To your point, we are planning to bring this item back to O&E once we have a little bit more clarity from Metropolitan. And you're right, there's a couple of things we need to sort out in terms of, you know, would we be able to receive special consideration in terms of the water that we would participate in terms of being drought-proof. Also, we need to understand South Coast's terms for participation. I know they're still trying to develop a template agreement for potential partners. So we need to understand what those terms are going to look like. They are counting on receiving the LRP funding of $475 from Met to be able to provide or pass that lower rate that we all saw to partners. So there's a lot of things that are still in flux, but I am working closely with Linnea, and we are engaged with both Metropolitan and South Coast to better understand those issues. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. I just would just hate to see an opportunity pass us by if it takes too long to look at this. So the U.S. Bureau meeting at Rancho California Water District, that was a really good meeting with the three other agencies and with the staff there. It was an opportunity for each agency to kind of talk about, you know, what they've done and how they've benefited with their partnership with the Bureau. And kind of it really showed and highlighted that regional collaboration that's taking place. And you could see that really resonate with the Bureau staff and how important that is. So I think that was a really good meeting that will only help us in the future. And I also thought that our general manager did an excellent job presenting Eastern's involvement and projects, and I really thought it was the highlight of the presentations. And then, just a good meeting with our general manager updates.
Thank you.
Director Corona.
I had a good meeting with general manager a couple weeks ago. Meeting yesterday with Rancho was very, very good, I thought. Went through the MET pricing strategy, the Cahuilla arrangement, and stuff like that. The Rancho remains to be very appreciative of having these meetings and keeping them up to date. And that's my report.
All right. On my list here, Riverside University Health System, I did not participate in that. Did attend the Eastern Western Ad Hoc Committee, which we gave various reports, and that was Joe always does a wonderful – Joe and the team does a wonderful job of representing us at those, and I think we had an opportunity to discuss some ideas that the general manager has over at Western on some statewide policy issues, probably more to come on that as that develops. I went to the weekend event for Valleywide. Director Record and I were both there and represented Eastern well at that event. Had a meeting with a company called Terra with April and Matt. They're a company that had approached me. They do a pill pouch program in which we, as we know, we don't want people flushing their used drugs and things into our system, so it kind of does that in a very eco-friendly way, and so they wanted an opportunity to talk to some of our both the public affairs and the smart people that run our system, and so we provided that. Thought that was a good meeting. IE Works board meeting, I did not have the opportunity to attend, and then as Joe noted, I was also not involved in the special district ballot selection committee. Did attend the annual celebration for Valleywide. It was their 50th anniversary of Valleywide. We had our team out there, Kevin, our water van, which was extremely popular because a little hot out at Diamond Valley Lake. So I was there for a while, and we had a really good. I mean, we actually had a line in front of our both the water van and just people asking a lot of questions. So I will just reemphasize. That water van we got has a lot of it's a huge draw, and I think that's one of the better investments we've made in our public relations here in a long time. And I hear it actually got used twice that day, so it was amortized well on Saturday. Had a great meeting with Laura recently. We discussed, as I mentioned, I think we're going to the customer week and perhaps up for an award there. WRCOG meeting yesterday, I guess 2 days ago. Still a lot of closed session items on that regarding various the PACE program. I would note that Jennifer said, the WRCOG dinner is coming up. Steve Wozniak, one of the co-founders of Apple, is the speaker. That should be pretty interesting. I think that is on June 23rd. I will be attending, and so if you want to bring your son, I think it might be an interesting program that evening. I don't want to quite take my kids, but if you want to bring yours,
be my guest.
You can bring yours. And then I had the opportunity to have lunch the other day with IEUA President Steve Eli and discuss some of our ideas for perhaps also getting involved with what I'm calling our Inland California Expanding Our Water Resources Project. And I had a very good discussion with him yesterday on that. So that's my report. Director Slauson?
Yes, I attended the joint meeting with Western, and we discussed things of common interest. And I refer you to President Pauley's previous report. Mm-hmm. I'll incorporate those. Those are hereby incorporated mm-hmm. into my comments. I attended the Chamber of Commerce discussion, a presentation from the Soroptimus. update from the City of Moreno Valley by Councilmember David Marquez. And did not attend the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce meeting. They did not hold one. And attended SAPA yesterday, and they just discussed the Integrated Regional Water Management Roundtable, and we approved an RFP for to hire a network coordinator. And we had a discussion on cloud seeding. That'll come back to us. That's it.
All right, very good. That will bring us to director's comments, future agenda items. Does anybody have any future potential agenda items or comments? I want to add one, and Joe touched on this during his presentation. I think it might be interesting to have an informational item, maybe May or June, about inflation. I mean, I know, Matt, we're having chemical costs rising. I know some of our gasoline rising. Just in general, maybe how inflation, I know we're not economists, but just how it's affecting the district.
Absolutely.
So that we can kind of get a handle on that. I don't think it's going away, so I'd like to have at least a couple smarter people than I give the board a report on that. So
we'll do that, President.
Very good. With that, Mr. Legal Counsel, I understand we have a need for closed session.
We do, Mr. Chair, as identified as items 9A and B on today's agenda.
And are we going to do that in here?
Yes, we are, President.
All right, so let's take about 5 minutes to switch over. Are we good? All right. We're back from closed session. Mr. Legal Counsel, could you give a closed session report, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The board met in closed session pursuant to Government Code Section 54957.6 to discuss with General Manager employee organization. No formal action was taken on that matter. The board also met to discuss potential litigation under 54956.9. Report was given to the board. No reportable action on that matter. That concludes my closed session report.
Very good. With that, we will stand adjourned until 9 a.m. on April 20th. Thank you, everyone, for a great meeting.
Thank you.